You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on the Progressive Voices Network.
What's in a name? By definition, the name of a person, place, or thing is its personal designation, a distinct way of being known to others. Unless, of course, it's the opposite, a label meant to disguise who or what a person or thing really is. In other words, a fake name. Hiding one's true identity can be done for many legitimate reasons, but it's widely used these days by flim-flammers and corporate front groups. For example, Restaurant Workers of America is not made up of waiters, cooks, bartenders, etc. It's a front group for chain restaurant owners who oppose raising the sub-minimum wage of their actual workers. Such astroturf citizen groups often hide behind patriotic-sounding names like Americans for Prosperity, to run massive campaigns of deceit to benefit the corporate sponsors at the expense of the public interest. And now, from out west, comes a brand spanking new group, Cowboys for Liberty. What a positive moniker. Cowboys are seen as down-to-earth, straight shooters, and America is all about liberty. But wait, is this just a front for corporations wanting to grab our public lands? Au contraire, as the old cowhands say. It's an audacious, fun-loving network of hell-raising climate change activists who are out to expose, shame, and defeat the corporate-serving profiteers behind the climate denier industry. They chose the cowboy image both to symbolize the true West ethic of defending Mother Nature and as a spoof of the Orwellian perversion of language by dishonest corporate powers. This is Jim Hightower saying, but Cowboys for Liberty is more than a name. It's a public campaign to unveil the shameful, avaricious individuals who are behind climate change pollution, putting their personal wealth and political advancement above the well-being of all other earthlings. Join the campaign at www.whydeny.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
So you don't need to be a rocket scientist to figure out things are not going well for the working class in this country. Yet all we hear coming out of the administration is how wonderful and how great the economy is, how Wall Street's fat and happy, and how never better. It's never been better. And for some, absolutely positively the truth, it has never been better for some. But for people who work, for people who toil, for people who struggle, I got to tell you, that $4,000 Trump prize we were promised never really materialized. In fact, I don't think I saw anything really coming out of the Republican tax scheme. But here to share some thoughts on why the middle class is in trouble and why ultimately the working class is in trouble as well, I've asked our good friend David Matlin from the Center for American Progress to come talk and share some thoughts on, well, why and how we turn things around. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Rick, thank you very much for having me.
So, I mean, you know, look, I think most people who get up every day, they work hard, they play by the rules, and at best they're stagnated over the last decade or two, if not declining the standard of living. They know something seriously wrong, yet all the messaging we hear, man, is how great it is.
Yeah, well, I think because the reality, as you said, is pretty bleak when you talk about, you know, basic things that affect most people, their wages that they're dependent upon. And, you know, the typical worker, their wages have not increased for about four decades. You know, and yeah, there's been some slight ups and downs, but over that whole period, pretty much nothing. Meanwhile, we know costs of important things like housing and health care have gone up much faster than inflation. So people are really feeling squeezed, especially when they see those at the top getting almost all of the gains of the economy, because we have been become a much richer country over those four decades. Just most people haven't gotten much of those riches.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we keep hearing about how wealthy we are as a country. We're at the wealthiest point in history. We're the wealthiest country in the history of civilization at its wealthiest point. I've heard that, a number of times, yet we still have hungry. We still have homeless. We still have kids going to bed at night with empty bellies and not knowing where they're going to sleep tomorrow. We still have all of these problems. And we also have, as you've pointed out, a working class with stagnant wages and health care that is just, for most people that I know who get up every day and struggle, healthcare is that issue where you go, 20 years ago, we didn't have these problems. And just the constant struggle. And people are looking for why. And I go, well, it's simple to me. As a guy who spent most of my lifetime working union jobs, it's because we don't have enough workers in unions.
Yeah, the decline of unions has been one of the biggest stories in these problems. And that's for a couple of reasons. So the things the unions do, first, they give workers some power at their particular workplace to improve the conditions and to get higher wages. And then when there's enough workers who can do that, those benefits tend to spread to other workplaces. So even non-union competitors tend to raise their wages. So that's not happening anymore. In fact, unions, when you're negotiating, are often just trying to hang on to what they've got. The other thing that's not happening is... Workers need a voice in our political system, and unions help give them that. They help organize people, bring them together so that they have a voice. They keep them educated about what's going on, and they help mobilize them to vote. And without that, our political system is almost totally responsive to the very rich who pay the lobbyists, who spend all sorts of money on campaign contributions. And so we have workers losing power in their workplace and in politics. And that is combined to create this huge, huge problem where the middle class and working class are getting really the short end of the stick.
Yeah, I tell the story all the time. I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and it was because of a union job that my kids will never see the desperation and poverty that I grew up in. And I now live in a neighborhood with doctors and lawyers because the work that I did was compensated at a decent rate. And look, I worked hard, I played by the rules, and ultimately I was able to get ahead. And it's that kind of meritocracy that even I believe in, that if you do work hard and play by the rules, that you should get ahead. And I think that's one of those things that we as Americans have internalized as part of our DNA almost. But yet it's just not happening. And the argument that I get from people all the time is that unions are bad because, well, it raises the cost of labor. And they've the wealth class of this country has almost put that into our DNA, which is kind of scary to me.
Yeah. So, my view is that stronger unions are about the only thing that can get us out of the current situation we're in. And that's, as I talked about the power in both the workplace and in politics. And so we were talking earlier before the radio show about Janus, for example, one of the efforts that the powers that be have been trying to use to kill unions, which is this case that said that public sector workers can get the benefits of union without having to pay the cost, which is just one more way to sort of weaken the ability of unions to do all these good things we've talked about. And so that, over the past several decades, unions were used to represent about 30% of all workers, and now down to 11% of all workers. At the same time that that's happened, sort of the share of the pie that the working and the middle class got has declined significantly. So the middle 60% of all of the nation's income, the middle 60% of all workers in the economy used to get, in the late 60s and early 70s, used to get about 53% of all the pie. So 60% were getting a little less, but they were getting a decent chunk of it. Now, as unions have declined sharply, they're getting little over 45%, which is just about the record low that they've ever got. Meanwhile, of course, we know that all those gains have gone to the top, and the top are now getting the highest share of the nation's income, basically, that they've ever received. And so, yes, this is a bleak picture that we're looking at, but we also... The signs of optimism I take is that the public is increasingly recognizing the value of unions and is more supportive of unions now than they pretty much ever have been. And they think unions provide value in the economy. They think they would join a union if they could. And so we have this push, and you even have elected officials being more more and more willing and open to actually talk about the value of unions.
Yeah.
So we're still a long, long way from where we need to go, but I think you see some of the makings of a comeback.
Yeah, not to crush your optimism, but you know, I look at the ossification of our labor laws and how badly the pendulum has swung in favor of the employer class. And, you know, crushing the ability of workers to join unions. And, you know, I'll tell you, I look at President Obama as one of those people who, while he was a candidate, he never had a problem talking about how wonderful unions were, and it was effusive with praise. And yet they did, well, virtually nothing to make it easier for people to join and form unions. I know they sped up a little bit of the election time, but still, when you can browbeat someone in a captive audience meeting, and get away with it, you know, I don't know why hurrying up is going to help that much anyway.
Well, yes, the law is rigged against workers who want to join a union. We have in the United States about the worst labor laws of the entire advanced world. We have the weakest, lowest union density of any countries. And in fact, our union density in the private sector right now is lower than it was before the National Labor Relations Act was created in the 1930s. That was the law that was supposed to sort of enable workers to be able to join unions, and that law has been so weakened that unions are, you know, workers are able to join unions or to know much more than before that law was created. So, yes, the law is hugely tilted against workers, and, yes, for decades, politicians have given just sort of very weak lip service to the cause of unions, but I do sense something different now, and that's, you know, part of my job is to talk to elected officials about these kinds of issues. There seems to be a greater fear of what our country is becoming, and that means also a greater willingness to talk about real solutions. And so, yeah, it's still possible that the politicians won't follow through and just go with the money, but I sense a lot of energy and interest and optimism around what unions can do. And you can see that, you know, you saw the teacher strikes, last year. Those were hugely popular amongst the public,
right,
and they were quite successful in raising wages.
Yeah, but does it have to get to the point where you're so desperate that you have no alternative? I mean, if you looked at some of the tweets that were coming out of Oklahoma and you look at the conditions under which those teachers taught and those students learned, I mean, they were at least a decade behind making an argument for better wages and conditions, and it had to get to a point to where, you know, finally people were like, you know, we just can't do this. Does it have to get to that?
I don't know.
Because I have some libertarian friends who say, you know, we shouldn't have any labor laws. It should be, you know, workers should be able to get screwed over, and it should be desperation. And then they wake up and go, oh, we should organize and we should fight back.
Well,
and
that at some level. So I think that's sort of crazy. One, because we're humans and we can do better, but also, that's sort of, I don't know if you read Marx, that's sort of his theory, is that the oppressed will rise up once economic conditions become so bad. But there's really very little truth to that, because the way power works, if people have so much power at the top, they can do all sorts of things to keep people down. And so my view is what we need to do is be a little bit smarter about that and create the conditions that enable workers to fight back. And we shouldn't have to get to, like, what is the bottom, when we're like digging in dirt again and looking, scratching for food? Or there is sort of no actual, you know, level that can be considered the bottom. It's just things could be a whole lot better, and we have the powers to change them. And when people come to that realization that they have the power to change them and take action, you know, that's sort of what all organization is about, and all organizing is about is encouraging people to realize the power that they have to change the situation.
No, absolutely, and I'm with you on that. And I think we should be using smart policy. But my fear is what we're right now, we're looking down the barrel of a Supreme Court that will undo the entire 20th century. I mean, all of the New Deal, I think, will be under assault with this Supreme Court once you get Kavanaugh seated, if he gets seated, or if they put someone who is just as bad, if not worse, in his stead. It's one of those moments where you go, you know, what's it going to take for us as a society to really push back and say no more? I mean, how much more do you take? Is the question.
Well, I don't know. I do think people are willing, you know, so the Supreme Court, I share your fears. You know, we are going to sort of with you know, Lochner era kind of jurisprudence, which that this is named after the, you know, the leaders of the court who thought that child labor laws were unconstitutional, that basically anything to make the economy work better for workers and the working class was unconstitutional. And so, yes, these extremists who are being considered for the Supreme Court really have a chance to undo so many of the things. But, and here is the public is with us on the value of unions. The public is with us on the concerns about stagnant wages, on concerns about extreme inequality. And I think to be credible, you know, so while we can talk about Donald Trump, who has not delivered in any way on these claims, he ran as a different kind of politician. That he was going to be not the same old standard Republican that was just going to help the rich. He was going to do something different. He was going to be a workers' president. He was going to raise wages. While he hasn't done that at all, and in fact, I wrote a piece where I talk about all the things he's done to harm workers, he showed that I don't think it's credible anymore to just go with the same old policies and the same old rhetoric, and I think both sides now have at least started to say, you know what, we have a wages crisis and we have to do something about it. And that is fertile terrain for talking about real solutions.
No, I'm right there with you. And I've said from the, you know, 2015 on that he's stolen labor's message. I mean, he even stole, you know, he took Bernie Sanders' message, which was the exact same thing. I mean, I'm not a Trump supporter, but I think, you know, going after China and trying to reduce our trade deficit there is a good thing. And I'm not against the idea of using tariffs to try and do that. I know some people are, but something eventually has to be done. But at the end of this, you're right. I don't see anything that Trump has done to help the working class. And I see a lot of things that he's done to help his cronies and the very wealthy in this country.
Yeah. And, you know, so Trump clearly was right that trade was rigged and that we could do far better. I don't actually think he's going about it the best way, but he was exposing the weaknesses of the sort of the elite consensus of this is what's good for you and we're going to do it to you. And he provided a challenge against this sort of conventional wisdom that both parties were part of, that were screwing workers. And so I think there's much, much greater room now for people to push against the conventional wisdom that is harming unions. And so yeah, it's a really bleak time in United States history where, as you know, we have long period of stagnation of wages, we have record high inequality, and we have a democracy that is almost totally captured by the rich. So yes, what are our solutions to that? Well, there really aren't many other solutions besides stronger unions. All the other kind of policies you think need organized workers to make them work. Let's say you raise a really high minimum wage, but you still got to figure out some way to enforce it. Only organized workers can enforce that. Let's say you get money out of politics. Well, the rich still have all sorts of built-in advantages. You need to have workers have some organized power in the political system. Only unions can deliver that. So I think we talked about how bad the conditions have to get before people fight back. Well, I think just at a minimum, the solutions are pretty clear and that unions help deliver some of the key solutions we need.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think it's pretty clear that we're at a point right now of, I talk to people all the time who are, they're almost at desperation levels. I mean, you talked about the Lochner era there for a second. And, you know, we're almost back to, you know, Joseph Lochner and the bakery making people work 60 hours a week for poverty wages and that whole era of if you're hungry enough and desperate enough to work in deplorable conditions for poverty wages, it was your choice, it was your freedom, it was your liberty to do such a thing. And look, they're making the same bad arguments today that they did back in 1905. And at the end of it, the hope is that we wake up and wise up and fight back. But David, I appreciate the time, the thoughts. Really good stuff.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, and if the subject's a little depressing.
No, look, I mean, the hope is, you got to know what the problem is before you can get angry about it. And then once you get angry about it, we know how to move forward and fix it. And I appreciate the time, man. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Good stuff. David Madlin, senior fellow and senior advisor to the American Worker Project there at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. If you want to check out his stuff, AmericanProgressAction.org, the website. We'll make sure we get the article out so folks can take a good look at it. Quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We're the first ones to die. The first ones in line for that pie in the sky. And we're always the last when the cream is shed out. For the worker is working when the fat counts above.
We're the first ones to starve. We're the first ones to die.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day nearly 500,000 textile workers from Maine to Alabama walked off the job in a general strike. The United Textile Workers had launched an organizing campaign the year before. Within months, their membership had grown from 15,000 to well over 250,000. Working conditions and pay were abysmal. Normal work weeks averaged 55 hours. Child labor was widespread, and workers were always in fear of mill closings, pay cuts, and firings for suspected union activity. In the South, the industry had essentially been in a depression since the early 20s. The key issue was the stretch out. Workers were routinely expected to complete an increasing amount of work at the same rate and wage. For a brief moment, workers hoped their conditions would change when President Roosevelt signed the Code of Fair Competition the previous summer. It raised wages, limited hours, and prohibited child labor. It also allowed for union organizing. But the mill owners maneuvered around the code effectively, and the Textile Relations Board refused most workers' complaints. Fed up, workers walked out of the mill by the hundreds of thousands. They used the flying squadron tactic employed by Minneapolis Teamsters earlier that year, traveling from town to town, from mill to mill, calling workers out on strike. Mill owners were shocked. Within days, strikers confronted thousands of police and scabs. More than 40,000 National Guardsmen were called out in 16 states. Over the course of the strike, 16 people would be killed and hundreds more injured. After 22 days, union leaders called off the strike when President Roosevelt promised a government survey of industry conditions. It was an outrage, a betrayal, and a defeat felt for decades.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Now the lessons of the past were all learned with workers' blood. The mistakes of the bosses we must pay for. From the cities to the farm and in trenches full of mud. Cause war has always been the boss's way, sir.
Yes, there is power in a union. And look, I think David hit it, you know, spot on the head. Look, as we've seen union density decline, as we've seen the constant attacks on workers' rights to organize, to collectively join together, form unions, fight for better wages, hours, conditions, all of that, we've seen a decline in not just the middle class, but in the wealth of the working class. And the numbers that he threw out, staggering. I mean, when 60% of the country was getting, well, I think he said, 54% of the income, now down to 45% of the total income. That is a massive, my Tea Party friends, that's what redistribution of wealth looks like. That is what a massive redistribution of wealth looks like. That huge portion from 54 down to 45%, that, you know where that percentage went. It didn't go down to the bottom of the economic scale. It all went to the very top. And to use the QAnon idiots code language, the tippy top, right all the way up there, the tippy top. So there's some code for you right there. When all of the wealth goes to the tippy top, that's where it's supposed to be in their world. And look, David brought up the Lochner era, which, you know, for those who know, you go back to the 1905 New York Bake Shop Act, where the state of New York said, hey, you know, we don't want bakers in this state working 100 hours a week. It's not healthy for them. It's not healthy for customers. We want them to be able, you know, to shower and, you know, to have some downtime. And when they get sick, take time off so they're not coughing all over stuff that people are consuming. And, you know, Joseph Lochner said, you know what, don't care. My bakers are going to work 100 hours if I want them to, and you're not going to tell me. And they eventually took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the court at the time threw the New York Bake Shop Act out under the idea of liberty of contract, which was the key phrase at the time. We're now hearing the same kind of rhetoric, only it's now freedom. It's no longer about liberty, it's freedom. Freedom to contract, freedom to do what you want. You have the freedom to make your own deal. And I've said for years, you have the right to make your own bad deal as long as it doesn't affect me. And right now what's happening is we're so divided as a country, not just politically, but also in the workforce, that, you know, I'm going to get mine. And generally getting mine means you're going to end up getting screwed. But never mind. Which ultimately brings down conditions for everybody. And we know this. I mean, you can see this play out time and time again. And they understood this back then. They understood that, you know, hey, there are varying levels of desperation. So if we can get those people who are way down at the bottom to work for, oh, I don't know, a buck an hour, like Ron Paul thinks the minimum wage should have been. In fact, they believe there should be no limits. No minimum wage, no maximum hour laws, no safe workplace laws, none of that stuff. This is the extreme conservative ideology. This is the ideology that the court in this country, the Supreme Court, is moving towards. And their hatred of organized people. Love organized money. Love that. Corporations are good. But organized people, not so much, because those organized people tend to want things. They tend to want things like, oh, I don't know, the eight-hour day. They tend to want things like maximum hour laws. They tend to want things like health care and retirement security and safe workplaces and education for their children and safe neighborhoods. And you can go down the list of all the things that organized people tend to want. And, you know, I've always said that, you know, we the people have, you know, we've out-procreated the 1%. They have all the money. And we've given it to them, but there's still more of us. And if we could get our heads right, if eventually we could pull our heads out of our behinds and stop with this nonsensical, infighting over social issues, you know, gay marriage or abortion or any of that, and focus on economics. And look, I think I'm on the right side of those social issues, but ultimately those should be individual liberty items. It's your right to do whatever it is in the confines of your four walls that you do with consenting adults, of course, but you have the right to do with your life what you want. That and as long as it doesn't infringe on my ability to live, breathe, exist, then we're fine. And I live my life that way. You know, you do whatever you're going to, you, as my daughter says, you do you. And I like that. That's an interesting little turn of phrase now that this generation, you do you. Live your truth. But, you know, your rights shouldn't infringe on mine, as mine shouldn't infringe on yours. And this is what, you know, the conservatives tend to forget about, that their narrow-minded views are attempting to infringe on the rights of everybody else's. And, you know, to me, it comes back down, it's always been kitchen table economics, because you can't have power without having economic power. And workers have forgotten that in this country, because maybe things got okay for a while, to where there wasn't a constant struggle, to where maybe those harsh edges of capitalism weren't glaringly apparent. But guess what? We're getting back to those. And as this court, if Kavanaugh is confirmed, not sure if that's going to happen, or whoever replaces him, because there's a whole list of horrible, whoever that is that sits in that ninth seat is going to be the arbiter of the future of this working class and of this country. So it comes back to this point of, when do we wake up? And look, you know, as I was saying with David, that, you know, there's a libertarian view that, you know, things have to get horrible. Things have to get really bad. That only then will people rise up and break out the pitchforks and all of that, heads on platters and all that stuff. But the question is, how bad does it get? You know, it, the last time that it the kind of organizing that I believe is necessary happened was after a massive Great Depression and a global war. So I don't know that I want to hit that kind of rock bottom. I hope we're smart enough. And look, I was hoping in 2008 into 2009, there would have been that moment where the pain was real. Millions of families were losing their homes. Millions of workers were being booted to the curb. You know, you had the pain, you had the desperation. And yet we didn't see really the organizing. And maybe, you know, conservatives are right. Maybe it's because we had unemployment. Maybe it's because we had food stamps. Maybe it's because we had a safety net that kept those folks from hitting absolute rock bottom. But if you listen to the conservatives at the time, they wanted rock bottom. You know, I still remember Pat Toomey saying that, you know, he wanted the things to get much worse because then only then could we truly heal. Only then could we truly rise out of the flames like a phoenix returning to glory. And their glory is clearly the 1880s, where the robber barons ruled the roost and everybody else knew their place. That's the future of conservatism. That's what they want. And that's where they're moving us. Look at how they're attempting to destroy every institution of the 20th century. Every remnant of any organizing that built a prosperous working class, they're attacking with full force and vigor. And what's interesting to me is I get these emails all the time from people going, well, you know, unions are something we needed 100 years ago, but, you know, all they do now is raise the price of labor. And you go, yeah, that's the point. The point is to share in the wealth and the profit of your labor. That's the point. To sit down and go, okay, well, we made a dollar. We'd like half of that, please. We'd like, you know, 3/4 of that because we created it. How they, and this is one of those things that's just amazing to me, how they got us in the mindset that, well, you know, asking for a fair share of the wealth that we create is somehow bad. And it's and this has happened because, look, we've been living under these trade policies for way too long. And again, this is the one area that I agree with Trump on. Our trade policies are horrible. But this isn't just Trump saying it. You know, Sanders ran on this as well. The trade rules are rigged against working people, not just in the U.S., but in other countries as well. Corporate interests are the protected class. You know, I always say, you know, it's socialism for them. It's pure capitalism for us. You know, we make sure that they're taken care of at the expense of us. And, you know, I'm hoping at some point the working class of this country wakes up to that reality. And I don't like to use the word middle class because you kind of, I just don't like using it. Because it takes away from the idea that, you know, we work for a living. That you get up every day and you produce and you work hard and you sacrifice time with your family. You sacrifice time in your life. You're trading that precious commodity of your life, those hours of your life, for the ability to exist. And at some point, I ask the question, you know, how much is that worth? How much is that lone precious commodity that you have? How much is that worth? Is it worth $1 an hour? Is it worth two? Is it worth 10? Where is that worth? And I think for too long, we as working people have undervalued that precious commodity. We have undervalued ourselves and have taken for too long. You know, the old Huey Lewis song, I'm taking what they're given because I'm working for a living. Nothing infuriates me more than hearing that. That and the, well, I know they're, you know, it's crummy hours and it's, you know, the crappy wages and the healthcare is horrible. There's no retirement and it's dangerous conditions. But hey, just happy to have a job. How many times you heard nonsense like that? I guess it's because I've always been fortunate enough to have a union job and to have that union mentality that I can change things. That if I see something wrong, You know, right now there's that. I'm sure you've heard the phrase going through an airport, or you know, since you know 9/11, it's see something, say something. I've always believed that. You know, ever since the first day I punched a clock somewhere, that was the, you know, it wasn't that cute little tagline, but that was the idea that if you see something wrong, if there's injustice, you speak up, you say something about it, and you make it better. I remember I was doing organizing, and one of the things you would talk to people, you know, they go, oh, I don't want anything to do with it. I'm only going to be here 6 months. I used to hear that crap a lot. Only going to be here 6 months. And then 6 months later, you'd see him, you go, hey, where are you going? Well, you know, I'm going to be here 6 months more. And, you know, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, they're still there. And I used to argue, go, well, okay, you're only going to be here 6 months. How about you make things better for the next guy who comes behind you who's only going to be here 6 months? To where maybe he stays 7, 8, or 10, you know. Or maybe you decide, hey, I like it here now that things have changed and they've gotten better. I might stay. And it was just this kind of logic that, you know, even at the time, you know, I marveled at the sense of the lack of empowerment. We need to grab that back. You know, I think back to my grandparents' generation. You know, they were a generation who didn't put up with you know what. When something was wrong, they raced in and they fixed it. They demanded things to be better. We need that generation back. And I'll tell you, I think this millennial generation is that generation. I think these kids coming up now, these kids becoming politically active now, you look at these kids, the around the Parkland shooting and the organizing that's going on there, they've had enough. And maybe they're going to be that generation because they've watched their parents eat a ton of you-know-what. They've watched the struggles. They grew up during the era of, you know, people losing their homes and the stress and the desperation that came out of that. They watched their friends' parents lose homes, lose jobs, be treated horrible at work, broken homes, broken families, broken careers. And look, what I'm getting from them is they're not going to take it. And that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing when you have a generation of working class people saying, you know what, we're not taking it. And maybe we're going to see a bunch more strikes. Maybe we're going to see a bunch more marches in the streets. Maybe we're going to see a bunch more people saying enough. And just maybe we make things better. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'd love to hear it. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Could be the death of you and me, but we're not unarmed. Our weapon solidarity. Jim Beals and Karen Silkwood. The list goes on and on. With every year that passes, 60,000 more gone. Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers.
War on the workers.
Oh, it's a war on the workers. And it's time we started calling the shots.
Your proud defender of the working class majority.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1830. That was the day that the Reverend Richard Allen brought black leaders together at his Mother Bethel AME Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They met to discuss the rising white violence and discrimination toward black free residents in northern cities. 40 people answered Allen's call, representing 7 states. The delegates included many of the leading black ministers and abolitionists of the day. Those who attended risked personal harm as white mobs threatened the delegates. Due to the danger, the group met in secret starting on September 15th. Then, on this day, they began open sessions. For 5 days, the delegates considered multiple responses to the conditions black Northerners faced. They founded the American Society for Free Persons of Color for improving their conditions in the United States, for purchasing lands, and for establishment of a settlement in the province of Canada. The organization emphasized pushing for legal protections for
black residents in the United States. They focused on education as a means of uplifting and improving the lives of black citizens. But delegates also supported the idea of an outlet to Canada for those black families who wanted to leave for their safety. The National Convention reconvened several times over the next 3 decades. Multiple meetings were held at the state and local levels. These meetings gave black leaders a chance to devise coordinated strategies to stand up against the increasing violence and restrictive laws of the North and to call for an end of slavery in the South. One outcome of these meetings was the founding of labor schools to train black students in the skilled trades as a means to gain economic independence. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
I got news for you. And it's going down. Before you come home and tell me you're not angry. And I'll be leaving. And I'll be leaving town.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the floodgates, they be a opening as we're seeing more and more comments around Kavanaugh. Evidently had a certain kind of look that he wanted for his female interns. You know, kind of outgoing. I'm not sure what exactly that means, but, well, you can throw that out any way you would like. Also, some former classmates coming out saying, well, you know, we heard about that back then. There was rumors. There was some scuttle. I'm not going to say it happened or it didn't, but, you know, we did hear about it. Very, very interesting stuff going on. And look, it's only going to get worse. So if I'm Kavanaugh, I'm looking to the exits. Anyway, let's find out what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. Bob Nay, Talk Media News. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you, Rick.
So like any of these things, you know, as soon as the door opens, the floodgates, you know, as soon as the floodgates open, tons of stuff coming out.
Well, it always happens that way, you know. And then, of course, you might have seen the Senate chief staff guy for nominations for the Judiciary Committee, Grassley's committee.
Yeah.
He tweeted at 11 o'clock, and he tweeted at 1 a.m. Let's see, maybe somebody had a couple of pops. I mean, shockingly, that actually happens in D.C. Been there, done it myself, so... he tweeted, though, that, you know, about, you know, their lawyers haven't got back to him. His name was Davis. They haven't got back to him because in between TV shows, I guess they don't have time, things like that. A dumb tweet because it takes the mask off. He basically says it's Kavanaugh. You know, he's going to be in the court. So predetermining everything. So it's not a helpful deal for a staffer to do that, that two tweets from 11 to 1 a.m.
Yeah, or you know, one of those things could find himself on the unemployment line.
Correct. That's right. So this is the chief guy for nominations for the committee. So that was another little piece of intrigue out there. I mean, I suspicion that I'm assuming that Dr. Ford will not show, and then they will not question him, Grassley, and they will just have a vote. If it doesn't make it out of the committee, it can go to the floor anyway under the rules.
Right.
And I was looking at the Anita Hill timeline. It had been such a while, you know, I looked at that. And the FBI did their investigation in 3 days.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a videotape going around of Orrin Hatch saying that it was 3 days and that it was a good thing that the chairman and the ranking member of the minority, you know, were in agreement and they moved forward on this. And, you know, he was effusive with praise. And yet now, no, we don't need this. We're just going to have this hearing.
Now, the twist also to it was, interesting enough, Biden was chairman, Joe Biden at the time, and he, when they interviewed Anita Hill, which is because she had worked for Thomas, they interviewed her anyway for the background, right?
Right.
And when this started to come out, some staffers took it to Biden, and they were talking about anonymous, and Biden said, no, that will strap the committee's hands. And then the White House got involved, which would have been a Republican because that would have been Bush. And then they approved additional background checks, which how the FBI came into it. So that's how that process unfolded at that time.
Yeah, but Trump's not going to jump.
No, they won't do it. Now, you know, they could pull his nomination and then put Amy Barrett in,
right?
Which would make the conservatives very, very happy.
Yeah, they would be really tickled in the panties. Yeah, no question about that.
But if they did that, that would also ignite, because she's far worse on Roe versus Wade for sure. So that would ignite, you know, obviously a lot of the women. So they wouldn't want to do that at this point in time. Because Planned Parenthood has just doubled their political budget. It doesn't come out of taxpayers' money, but the money they raise to support themselves from people for donations for, you know, campaigns. And they're doubling their effort in targeting certain seats, because the Republicans, as you know, have more vulnerable seats, way far more than the Democratic side does.
Right. And there's an opportunity here. I mean, not a great one, but there's an opportunity. And I even see, you know, Claire McCaskill came out today and said that she was going to be voting against Kavanaugh, which, you know, it's one of those vulnerable seats. And immediately, you know, the Republicans there, you know, basically said, you know, she's a slap in the face to Missourians. And you go, this is one of those, you know, those political moments.
It is. Yeah, this has become a big deal.
As it should be. Look, at the end of the day, regardless of who you're going to seat on the court, I don't really want somebody who's accused of attempted rape. I mean, you look, we're going to get a crazy conservative on there. And as you said, Amy Barrett's probably much, much worse and to the right of even him. But, you know, at the minimum, across the aisle, we should be able to go, you know, I don't know that we want somebody who's accused of that. I mean, you wouldn't hire someone to cut your lawn or, you know, paint your house or anything like that if you knew. You know, why would you put them on the highest court in the land?
I mean, I was thinking this through. What would be the downside of, you know, let the FBI do, you know, something on it? Frankly, it's so many years ago, and they would have to say, you know, who was at the party? You don't know what I'm saying with this.
Right.
So it's a roll of the dice, and then eventually, you know, accuracy or truth comes out. But why not do it? For two reasons. One, if he then, you know, did do it, they would dump him and do the right thing. And how could they be criticized? They did the right thing. They dumped him. If, in fact, the FBI says nothing, absolutely nothing to it, and then they turn around and, you know, start attacking Dianne Feinstein first, of course, you know, and then go from there. And that's it. I mean, I don't see the downside to it.
Well,
either way.
For them, the downside is once you start going back and start questioning people under oath, of, you know, hey, if you lie and we find out, you could end up in jail. People start like this woman, this Christine King Miranda, who said, you know, I remember hearing about it, you know, when it was going on. You know, there was some buzz around that something had happened. I don't know what, I wasn't there. But the more you start piecing those stories together, the more those come out, the more, you know, the more credence it gives it, and you can't deny.
But then again, like I said, if it comes out the other way, then that's it. And, you know, they can slam the process of waiting 2 months. I mean, there's a lot of fuel there, if I'm saying. There'd be a lot of fuel there that they could use. I just think that they don't want even any one more day just due to the midterms coming up.
Nope.
Although, if it shows to be accurate later, wow, Katie barred the door about 2 months from now.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But even still, what happens? Let's say they seat him. Let's say Monday she doesn't come, and I'm hoping that she does. Look, it'll be ugly for her. And I think I've heard rumors that the Republicans are going to have female staffers actually ask the questions, which is kind of smart. But let's say she doesn't show up and they put him on the court. And then a couple months down the line, we find out, yeah, well, that's actually true. We're stuck with this guy on the court. What do you think of that? What do you think about having the female staffers, you know, instead of having, you know, somebody like Grassley asking questions?
Well, one time we were sent some horrible language letters, and I had a 16-year-old intern program where the Girl Scouts sent somebody to your office for the day, and that poor young lady opened these letters. And so I called the lobby group that had sent them, and when they got to my office, every woman that worked for me was sitting around the conference table. And they kind of looked at me, the group did, and I said, here's the letters that came in from your group. Would you please read the first letter here? And they look around the table and they said, well, we can't read them in front of these women. I said, well, 16-year-old girl read them. It was very effective, you know?
Yeah,
very effective. And I think if they want to soften the issue, yes, they would have a theme. And that way there's no harsh type of, male question.
Yeah, and there's no Arlen Specter moment, which is, for me, the whole reason you have the hearing.
Oh, that's a blast from the past, that name, yep.
You're throwing that out of your, because Orrin Hatch already said it. You know, maybe she's mixed up. You know, like, you know, maybe it wasn't him. Maybe it was a guy who just kind of looked like him. You know, those rich white guys all look the same.
Orrin Hatch has been on that committee forever. He's gone through how many of these?
Well, he was there for Anita Hill. I mean, you know.
I know. That's what I mean. He's still there.
Again, and and this is where the people who keep pushing term limits sometimes have my sympathy. I'm not a term limit person because I think voters should have the ultimate term limit vote. You boot the bums out. You keep people who are good. The sad reality is the bums usually end up sticking around too long.
Right, exactly.
I don't know. Let's move on. The wall. Evidently, okay. Trump's a little ticked about the Republicans' lack of courage on the wall. What's going on?
Well, he calls the budget ridiculous. Because I thought at first when I saw the headlines because maybe the ridiculous spending, but it wasn't. It's because the wall's not in it. So therefore, it becomes a ridiculous budget. You know, Trump really, really, really wants to get that wall at some point in time for the next election.
Well, that's his key. He couldn't get the destroy Obamacare. He's got to have his prize wall.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Maybe this is where he could go to his Russian oligarch friends and have them fund it.
He can't get it out of the Republicans. He's not going to get it if the chamber switches, I'll tell you that much.
No, that ain't going to happen there either. Well, good. I mean, and this is the thing that bothers me. I mean, you know, we can't figure out a way to end homelessness or hunger in this country, but, you know, we're going to talk about building a stupid wall and $13 billion for Space Force. You know, it's just crazy. Anyway, evidently the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, something with immigration. What are we changing with immigration here?
Well, the Congress is not honestly digging into this at all. Either side of the aisle, like they should.
Right.
This is the public side we're seeing right now. What he's doing is two things in the last 2 days. One, he's telling judges that they can't just dismiss a case. He's telling the immigration judges. That's number one. Then he followed up today with having a case personally referred to him about asylum seekers. Now, when they have a review where there's a deemed a danger in a review, that's a major hurdle they get through. In other words, probable cause that the asylum seeker is in danger. Well, the way he's going to review this case, he may say it doesn't matter. They're still going to detain them, put them into detention, versus the process where they have a potential danger, it's approved, they await their time.
Right.
He may change that. The other unseen thing is what's going on at embassies, and nobody is digging into this thing. I wish somebody from the committee would, from Foreign Affairs. The embassies are starting to turn down people, and I'll give you a case I personally know of where a student from India went in, and they were turned down because they said, well, we don't know when you graduate and return here if you can pay your loan in India. What does the American embassy care whether that's master's degree student can pay his loan in India?
That's bizarre.
That actually happened.
Wow.
And I can give you more cases. I can give you cases of four American women who were turned down to get married to boyfriends that they have been dating 5 to 6 years. Not a Facebook relationship, not a bot marriage, 5 to 6 years. All turned down with no reasons given.
Well, I mean,
these are done in the Philippines. It's being done in India. It's all at the embassy level, Rick. Somebody in Congress needs to dig in to demand the statistics.
Yeah, well, I mean, do we expect anything different out of this administration? I mean,
so that's what's going on, and now you see the public part where the Attorney General is starting to say, refer me this case, because justice can intervene and try to set the determination of how these cases run.
Oh, okay. So this is something they can do?
Oh, he could. I mean, he'd be challenged in court, but obviously it has to go through the whole court process. This is something where he's reviewing these cases right now. He's asking for these cases of these detainees. Then there's the second part, which is the unseen part that's going on all over the world in embassies.
That's something.
Immigration by embassy.
I'm going to have to ask my immigration expert friend
about that and see if there's any, if it's on his radar or on their radar. Because you know, I'll tell
see
you,
if it is. And he's more than welcome to call me.
Yeah, it's something that I haven't even thought of.
Yeah, nobody's talking about it.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Most certainly something. As soon as we're done, I'm gonna reach out. Okay. Lastly, evidently there's a group of Democrats who are pushing a petition to change the party rules to elect a speaker, because I guess a little confidence that they think Democrats are going to take back the House and may not like Nancy Pelosi. What's going on?
Well, I think a lot of people, you know, that wanted to go for Tim Ryan of Ohio when he opposed Nancy Pelosi for a minority leader thought, well, okay, he didn't win, but, you know, Nancy's really going to not seek speaker again. And the next thing you know, Nancy announced she was going to seek speaker. And I think 45 Democratic candidates, if my memory serves me right, said we won't vote for her, candidates that were running, you know, because of the polarization in the field. So now Nancy says she's going to run. So quietly, although nothing's quiet in D.C., it's leaked out that 10 of the Democratic members are trying to get a new rule within their caucus that if you want to be the speaker, you need to get 218 votes, not just get your name referred, you know, to the caucus, and then they take an internal vote, and if there's four of you and you take 70 votes, you win, and another person takes 20 votes, you know, that kind of thing. You'd have to get you'd have to get 218, making it therefore harder for her.
No, making it almost impossible for anyone.
Well, yeah, I should say you're right, impossible, not harder, impossible.
Yeah, I mean, right. Wouldn't it be possible? Impossible for just about anybody.
Right.
So then you wouldn't, maybe you have speaker by committee.
Maybe.
All right, well. Hey, I always love a good story of Democrats shooting themselves in the foot.
There you go.
So it sounds like that to me. Anyway, Bob, I appreciate
Thank
the
you.
Time. As always, good stuff.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much. Our good friend Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. Chances are you may never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, inspecting an elevator, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Go to this battle, take my union gun. Gonna end this world of slavery, for this war is one you're bound to lose. Are you fascist or bound to lose?
So to wrap things up for tonight, you know, again, I go back to our conversation in the first hour with Jordan Ewell. I just think, you know, what he was able to accomplish to help that gentleman is just quite remarkable. And again, you know, it's one of those things where there is hope for humanity. There's hope for us in this country. There is an opportunity for us to believe this. There's an opportunity for us to come back together, for us to care for one another, and do it in a way with, as Jordan said, you know, instead of hating each other, we need to be loving each other. And you know, in this country, in the wealthiest country in the world, at the wealthiest moment in history, the one thing we should be able to do is ensure that everyone has a roof over their head, that there is, you know, access to clean water and to food and to medical care. Just, you know, that's just my view. And again, I don't think it should be a partisan thing. And I look at this gentleman who, you know, if you watched the video as I did, you can clearly see that there's something there. There's, like I said earlier, they're either demons or some kind of health issue. And we find out, yes, it's all of the above. And I guess, you know, while you know, what got me to talk about it, which is, you know, these evil, the evil and mean spiritedness, the fact that Jordan was able to, you know, to bring people together and to do this is just quite remarkable, and good on him. And there's still time to donate. There's still time to kick in and help out. Just a great story. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast. The Rick Smith Show app on the smartphone. Take the program on the go wherever you go. And as always, you can email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Thanks so much for being here. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, in amorous raid. Democracy is coming.